This version of Ball and Chain by Big Brother and the Holding Company was recorded live at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967 and is largely responsible for bringing the band and its lead singer Janis Joplin to the world's attention. That's because Clive Davis was in the audience that day, and after hearing the performance, he knew he had to sign the band. It was a career-defining moment for both Janis Joplin and Mr. Davis. It gave him a reputation as a rock and roll pioneer at a time when the music industry was in great flux. And over the next 4.5 decades, Mr. Davis went on to run Columbia, Arista, and J Records. And in the process, he signed or developed some musicians you may have heard of: Bruce Springsteen, Dionne Warwick, Aretha Franklin, Carlos Santana, Alicia Keys, Patti Smith, Barry Manilow, Whitney Houston, Earth, Wind & Fire, and even Kenny G. Now he's written a tell-all memoir with the help of Anthony DeCurtis that reveals many behind-the-scenes stories about his relationships with some of the world's most acclaimed musicians. It's called The Soundtrack of My Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Clive Davis was a guest on our show in March. We are re-airing that interview for you now. I began by asking him, you describe yourself as one of the most far-out attendees of the Monterey Pop Festival that year that you first heard Janis Joplin, mostly because of the way you were dressed. Wasn't the dress code at rock festivals anything goes?
Well, this was an era, the beginning of Haight-Ashbury, so nobody except me perhaps didn't have robes or long flowing gowns or beads or flowers in your hair. And here I had no idea of what to expect, so I had on khaki pants and a tennis sweater. So that, you know, tongue-in-cheek really made me the far-out guy in the audience.
And people stared?
Well, no, I can't say that.
Do you think that coming to the music industry as an outsider helped because, to some degree, it allowed you to hear things others didn't, but also became a metaphor for your career?
Well, I don't know about the metaphor, but I had no musical training, and my parents died when I was a teenager, and I had $4,000 to my name, so I went through NYU and Harvard by scholarship, and to rise above the station, I studied to be a lawyer, became a lawyer, and then a lucky break 3 years in, I became the lawyer for Columbia Records, and after doing that for 5 years, I was made head of the company. So musically, I was ill-prepared for this awesome responsibility. They were big and huge in classical music and Broadway shows and middle-of-the-road music with Tony Bennett and Andy Williams.
They used to listen to the Make-Believe Ballroom.
I used to listen
with
to the
Martin
Make-Believe
Block.
Ballroom. So when I got to Monterey, and I had just watched, listened, observed for a year, I didn't know the revolution was going on. I didn't know a musical, cultural, social revolution was going on. And
despite being in school with other people, because growing up in New York with Make-Believe Ballroom on WNDW, there was also Alan Freed at Wins the same time.
But that Alan Freed didn't prepare you for Monterey Pop. The electrification of the guitar, seeing groups with horn sections like the Electric Flag, seeing this white soul sister, Janis Joplin, vibrating, compelling, electrifying. What happened to me, if the word epiphany is to have any meaning, is that I knew that I would have to step forward and sign my first act.
But it took you longer than you imagined. Big Brother didn't just sign immediately, did it?
Well, they were under contract to Mainstream Records. There was no record out officially. And I had to buy her contract from Mainstream Records. We settled. Albert Grossman, by that time, had become Big Brother's manager. We paid the aggregate of $200,000, $100,000 to be borne by Columbia, $100,000 by the artist. And that and began the relationship with the group and, of course, with Janis Joplin.
Now, you weren't the head of Columbia at the time.
Yes,
you were,
I was.
Oh, you were.
Yes.
How soon after that did she leave Big Brother and form her own group? Was
well,
that something that Columbia
after
wanted?
The first album was done with Big Brother, Cheap Thrills, and, you know, with Peace of My Heart becoming a big hit single, the word of mouth, the underground, the appearances, The campaign that we had, that album did shoot to the top of the chart, so that was very successful. It was in preparing for the second album that she had the wrenching decision as to whether to stay or leave the group.
The photos on your book's back cover illustrate just how many different styles of music you've had a hand in over the years. You're in pictures with everyone from Puffy to Jerry Garcia, but is there any musical genre that you most identify with?
Well, no. I mean, the answer is that when you work for a living, when you get into it, I found music as a passion. I never knew that it would dominate my life. I got confidence from a track record, you know, because after Big Brother, I then started, 6 weeks later, prepared by what I had seen in Monterey, I saw Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the Al Cooper Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I signed them. I responded to a call from the famous rock promoter Bill Graham and flew out to Fillmore West, and I saw young Carlos Santana and the Santana group. So it was over that period at Columbia, over the ensuing 6 years, where whether it was Springsteen when John Hammond brought him to me, whether it was Earth, Wind, and Fire, artists, self-contained artists that really have been my qualifications to get me into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I did get into about 12 years ago. And that gave me confidence that maybe I had an ear, maybe I had a natural, undiscovered talent I never, ever would have known that I had.
Now, if we back up a bit, you went to law school. Your parents would have preferred, I suspect, for you to stay in the legal profession and not go into the music business. But you didn't go, you didn't immediately jump into becoming the head of Columbia. You kind of slid into
it. No, I was a lawyer for Columbia Records. 3 years after I was at the Rosenman Law Firm, I became counsel for Columbia Records. I was counsel for Columbia Records for 5 years. And I was there, whether doing artist contracts for Gotti Levison, original cast album, going opening nights, setting up subsidiaries in England and France, or helping them beat the FTC in an antitrust suit. And I gained Goddard's confidence. It's not that he knew that I had ears. It's not that I knew that I might have ears. But when his executive vice president said that he wanted the musical instruments division, which was earmarked for me by Goddard, he then looked at me and he said, well, Norman Adler wants musical instruments and creative playthings. Okay, Clive, you'll be the head of Columbia Records. That's exactly how it happened. And, of course, I write all about that in the book.
Well, you said that you got your first taste of entertainment law when you were enrolled in a copyright law class that required you to subscribe to Variety. So a lot of this is serendipitous.
A lot of it is serendipitous, never hinting, you know, that what would await me? What would await me in the song area for Barry Manilow, for Whitney Houston, for Aretha Franklin and Dionne Warwick, and, you know, just a wonderful life in music that has been so fulfilling.
My guest is Clive Davis, who's written, with the help of rock critic Anthony DeCurtis, The Soundtrack of My Life. We're calling it a memoir?
Yes.
An autobiography?
Yes.
One of the stories that you tell about your early experience in the industry involves a Bob Dylan song called Talkin' John Birch Society Blues. He wanted to include it on his second album, but you prevented him from putting it on.
What would you say prevented? I was a young lawyer. I was asked to give a legal opinion. And, of course, I checked it with the outside law firm. And that there was a line in the song which said, they all, meaning every member of the John Birch Society, subscribes to Hitler's views, even though he killed 6 million Jews. Well, there was definite concern that that was a libelous statement.
Because, even if it's in a song?
Well, yes. I mean, you could libel someone in a song. And if you're a
member, because they're a neo-Nazi song.
If you're a member of the John Birch Society and you don't subscribe to Hitler's views, you're being libeled.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd be the Koch brothers' father, actually, who was a member of the John Birch Society. They probably would have sued you afterward. Has that ever come out? that record?
You know, I know that he ran into legal problems when he was going to do it on television because the network lawyers also said that it would subject them to libel if they allowed that. So there was a problem there. Obviously, in books, he could do anything he wants. But that was sort of an anonymous encounter as a young attorney.
When I worked in the record business, I was always surprised that if you asked people what their favorite records were, they always just listed the ones that were on the top of the charts. They didn't separate their personal taste from their professional taste. What about you? You have said here that rock and roll wasn't really to your taste at the start.
No, in my early years, there's no question that the music that I related, first of all, I love the Mamas and Papas. When they came out, I know that we became friends. By that time, I was head of Columbia, and I just loved the music, the vocal harmonies, Mama Cass's voice. I always have been an incredible admirer of the writing of Paul Simon, the work of Simon and Garfunkel, of course, later Paul individually, but
one of your artists?
But I never discovered them, but I worked with them, and I did help them choose Bridge Over Troubled Waters as the first single, which has always amazed them in their, when I read their retelling of our history.
Well, I imagine that Foo Fighters might not be your taste, but you speak of them very fondly in the book. You've certainly sold a lot of their records.
Yeah, I take issue with you. I think you're prejudging what my taste is.
I said I imagined.
Yeah, I know. So I'm saying to you that I love rock music. I was involved when you realize, you know, with all the rock artists that I signed, plus I attracted the Grateful Dead and I attracted the Kinks, and I signed and discovered Patti Smith, and I really was at the cutting edge with Lou Reed and Graham Parker and Ian Dury, so that I don't have any one particular kind of music. Granted, in recent years, I'm known for the songs that I found for entertainers who don't write. But that, to me, never obscures. Like this year, for my pre-Grammy party just 2 weeks ago, I brought back the Patti Smith group. I was first to put on Mumford and Sons, and I made sure the Lumineers were on the bill. So I love great music, whatever the format.
And your Grammy parties are a mix of talent that would otherwise not usually mix. That's your goal.
I mean, a few years ago when I asked Alicia Keys, what is your lifelong dream? She says, to sing on the same stage with Aretha Franklin. So I accomplished that for her. And now this year, along with Patti Smith, along with Miguel and the Lumineers and Emily Santee, and Patti Smith, I had a duet between a great young singer getting recognition, Jennifer Hudson, with an all-time great, Gladys Knight. And I had them both do a duet of I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And I can assure you, nobody was sitting when they ended.
My guest is Clive Davis, who's currently the chief creative officer of Sony Music Entertainment. He has written a memoir called The Soundtrack of My Life, with the help of Anthony DeCurtis. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had in March with Clive Davis, a key player in the music business. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and now he's the author with Anthony DeCurtis of a memoir called The Soundtrack of My Life, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I pointed out, when you joined Columbia, the label was behind the times. Pretty much all of the other labels had signed major rock acts, and Columbia was just trying to catch up.
Yes, now they had Bob Dylan.
Yeah. But he was the first breakthrough, wasn't he?
He was a breakthrough critically. You know, his songs were being done by the Byrds and Peter, Paul, and Mary, his career. He was known, his influence, but not as a major record seller. And the Simon and Garfunkel were, their record of Sounds of Silence, as I was appointed, was just being released. But after Monterey with Santana, Chicago, Blitzwing, Tears, Janis Joplin, you know, that really moved into a different area of rock for them, and our market share really exploded.
Now, when you were made the head of the company by Gotthard Lieberson, a legendary figure in his own right in the record business, but more in the classical side, did you have any idea of what your job really entailed?
No. I did not at all, and I had to feel my way. So I listened to everything I could. I just read everything that I could. And I learned something very important during that period. For the A&R men, the gifted A&R men that were there, that were doing Tony Bennett, that were doing Streisand, that were doing Andy Williams, they were successful, and they were not interested in any thing occurring in rock. And Mitch Miller, who was the quintessential A&R man, was very anti-rock. So there was an atmosphere there of thinking this was going to be ephemeral. This was not lasting. And, you know, the fates aligned, and I was in Monterey, and I made my move, and it encouraged me, and I just felt my way through and got confidence via the track record that I was building.
And as you mentioned earlier, you were gaining a reputation as the man with the golden ears because of an ability to spot a hit. I've been at recording sessions where everybody felt so great about a song and said, "That's the hit." And of course, it went nowhere. So how do you really spot a hit?
Well, when I formed Arista after Columbia, I went into an area of music, the song, in addition to all the self-contained rock artists. I continued the rock emphasis, but...
Which is singer-songwriter.
Which is singer-songwriter and self-contained. But I had signed Barry Manilow, and I listened to his material. He was unknown at the time. And I submitted to him Mandy, and he arranged it. And the first record we released on Arista became a number one hit, established the practice of having a Grammy party other than the night of, so this is my tradition to this date. And that led me to be song-oriented, hire A&R people that felt the power of a great copyright. And it's that led me, when I was overquoted with the two spots that Barry gave me on each album, to sign Dionne Warwick. And with I'll Never Love This Way Again and Deja Vu and Heartbreaker, and That's What Friends Are For, extend this icon's career. That led me to the great Aretha Franklin. And I write in the book of my years with the great Aretha.
She had left Atlantic, and you signed her for Arista.
That is correct. And I didn't have the illusion that I was going to come up with R-E-S-P-C-T or Natural Woman. Radio had changed. But with Who's Who and Who and Jump to It and Freeway of Love and I Knew You Were Waiting for Me and Sisters Are Doing It for Themselves, we did extend Aretha's career for decades at the top of the chart.
And you also thought about other things, the way performers looked and did their stage acts. Were you influenced by Berry Gordy and Motown when you suggested that Sly wear a certain kind of costume or Bruce Springsteen present himself in a certain way on stage?
No, I was not. I'm a great admirer of everything Berry Gordy and Motown did, but that was an earlier era. I didn't look at that. We were the era of albums. When I tell in the book the story of Sly and being concerned that this rock, blues, jazz, funk master might be impeded because I could get album play by the platinum hair and the satin costumes, I learned his genius did not need modification. So although I suggested it, and he politely did his thing as he should, you learn on the way, and I'm, you know, I stated exactly what happened in the book. For Bruce Springsteen, I only suggested that he make use of a large stage like Radio City. It was in L.A., because he had only played Max's Kansas City and CBGB and could be stationary. So that was not the case. He does nicely give me credit for challenging him and provoking him to write two radio-friendly songs after Greetings from Asbury Park that turned out to be Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night. So for that and the graceful way that Bruce presents things, I'm in his debt. He, of course, as a live performer, needless to say, became the best live performer, I think, in the history of rock and roll records. But I did want to say that In the String from Manilow, Dion, Aretha, that is what prepared me for the years with Whitney Houston when I discovered her in 1983 in the middle of her mother's act and became her creative partner until she died. And I go through our life together in the book of my finding the song, meeting with her, paring it down, and becoming, in effect, quote, her industry father.
And hearing that a Dolly Parton song would work very well for her. For
you know
example.
Who discovered that? That was Kevin Costner in The Bodyguard. It was Kevin that
really,
found
in
that
the movie.
Song. It was Kevin that suggested it. Whitney and I and David Foster loved the idea, so I Will Always Love You closes the Bodyguard film.
Clive Davis is my guest. It's fitting that the title of his memoir is The Soundtrack of My Life, since he's written the soundtrack for many of our lives, although through his work with many superstars in the music industry. His book is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I suspect if you told Miles Davis what to do on stage, he just would have ignored you.
You know, I don't make a practice of that. You take it as you come.
Well, I mean, he was famous for turning his back on the audience.
No, but I'll tell you what I did with Miles Davis, and I write about that in the book. He came to see me and used the F word in describing why was I signing Blood, Sweat, and Tears in Chicago, and they were selling millions of albums, and he was notwithstanding the respect as the premier musician of our age. And I said, Miles, we'll make a deal. You have got to promise me that you're going to go out in person and not just play jazz clubs, not just play the Village Gate or Shelley's Manhole. I will get you Santana, Laura Nero, you know, other artists you could play before college audiences and Fillmore's up and down, which we did, and he did. And I'm happy to say, I said, I can't tell how you'll benefit, but I know something's going to happen. And it led to Bitches Brew and my special relationship with Miles, where he even bought an outfit for me to wear to one of his concerts. And, of course, I wore it. And the picture of the two of us together is in the book, is very close to my heart, frankly.
Do you feel as if running a corporation whose profits come from creative products like books, albums, films, is different from running any other kind of corporation?
Yes, I do. You've got to be very sensitive to the creative spirit. You're in the creative arts. It's a whole different cup of tea. Music is not a product. In a sense, literally, of course, it might technically be, but it's an art form. And, you know, whether you're dealing with pathfinding artists, you know, that those discoveries that I know as far as my legacy, those, whether it be the Patti Smith, whether it be Alicia Keys, whether it be Springsteen, whether it be Santana, they have gotten me in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and that is part of my legacy. But also finding songs for artists who don't write and seeing them today be copyrights, going to Broadway 40 years later to see Barry Manilow, where every song is known to the public, part of the fabric. Poor Whitney and the tragedy. But when you go over her body of work, when you listen to her greatest hits album and you realize these are just not hit records, these are standards today that everybody knows, that is both poignant for me, gratifying to me, and the reason why the song that I have picked maybe 7 or 8 orders, iconic orders, to say your career should not be over. Don't tell me a recording artist is only 10 years or 15 years. So whether recently it's been for Rod Stewart, the Great American Songbook, or whether it was for the years with Aretha, or signing a Luther Vandross and then doing Dance with My Father before his diabetic early death, I love the idea. With Santana, it happened twice. I signed him early and then 25 years later.
The song most people associate with Barry Manilow, they think he wrote, which is I Write the Songs. It was actually written by one of the Beach Boys.
That's true, Bruce Johnson. That's true.
Did
but
you
Barry's
find that?
Arrangement.
Uh-huh.
That was recorded before.
Uh-huh.
Barry sweated over that song, sweated it for a year or two. I just got a letter from him, sir, this morning, saying how much he loved this book, but recalling how he sweated over that song, not to fight it, but to find why will this be a classic. He solved it. He found it. And, of course, it is a classic.
Though we mentioned your success with Janis Joplin earlier, you say that one of her most popular songs, Another Piece of My Heart, need a little doctoring before it could be considered radio-friendly, and you wound up going and
well,
doing the editing
doctor,
yourself?
It needed simply an edit. In those days, if you were over 3 minutes, at most 3:20 or 3:30, you would not be played by radio. And here this cut was well over 4 minutes. And I realized that the essence of it, the hook of it, everything about it would qualify it as a big hit. So what I did was that I shortened a lengthy instrumental, and I brought back a chorus, because the single has got to have repetitions of that hook, that chorus. And that was the root. I told their FM stations, they would play the album version. But for AM play, we needed a certain length and a certain structure.
3 minutes.
She did buy into it. The record became a big, big hit. And the album went to the top of the charts.
Eventually, your time with Columbia came to an end, although it seems rather petty.
Say that again?
The reason that you wound up leaving Columbia,
yes,
seems rather petty in retrospect.
Well, I have a full chapter in that, certainly creating the record, that it was a painful dismissal from Columbia Records, allegedly for charging my son's bar mitzvah to my expense account report, which I never did, which I prove I never did. It led, when the person at Columbia who created all this trouble from fraudulent invoices was helping to deflect his sentence, he said there was payola within the industry and Columbia. I did have to go through the pain of 2 years of not publicly commenting until we were all vindicated. There was no payola at Columbia, and I'm happy to show the check that Columbia and CBS gave me when I formed Arista just for future mail order rights for the artists that we would come out with for $1 million. And, of course, within the 106 photos in the book, I include a copy of that check.
Well, which, Arista was obviously a vindication for you. It became a giant success. It was almost a way of saying to Columbia, you should have kept me. But were you given more freedom because it was your own company? Did you feel free?
I always had freedom until the incident occurred at Columbia at the end. I must say that God had delegated, that the success was meteoric, that the doubling, tripling of market share was there. So that, of course, there was skepticism in the outside world that a lawyer with no training could really be doing this. So I did have to go through some brickbats that I was claiming more than I was really doing. But I knew that I was the only one in seeing Santana or a few of these artists, so that when I finally did it at Arista again and did it in a variety of circumstances, I think all those issues fell by the wayside.
Much has been made about the fact that you come out as a bisexual near the end of the book. Why did you feel it was necessary to include that in this memoir?
You know, if you're doing your autobiography and you're doing the story of your life. You've got to do and include everything. Other than that, there was a considerable demand for it. I didn't want any book coming out as a biography. And so at the end of the book, in the last chapter, I do point out that when my second marriage failed, every experience that I had prior to that was heterosexual. I opened myself up to the person, not the gender, and I found that I was able to have a relationship with a man. So I include that, and I state that although, of course, I have four children, I have six grandchildren, my older grandchildren, my children always knew, my close friends always knew, that the attitude towards bisexuality is you're either gay, you're straight, or you're lying. Well, that's just not true. And so that if by at least outlining my story, it could lead to a more constructive step where people will understand that bisexuality does exist. You can be attracted to both women and men. Ultimately, for me, it occurred after I was 50, but it just meant I was bisexual. And I think it should be better understood.
We're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to ask a question that a listener has written in. Sheldon from Brooklyn wants to know if you miss vinyl records. People seem to have a certain fondness for them now. They're selling again.
I have a fondness for the people who love vinyl records. I myself don't listen to it, but I must say I have a fondness for CDs and the wonder of CDs. But I encourage the love and the passion for vinyl.
Now, of course, the Internet is what is restructuring the bottom lines of record companies.
There's definitely
Do you use an iPod?
I do. I have an iPhone. I use an iPod. But I also play my CDs. You know, I come home every week to make sure I don't go over the hill. Every new record, when it hits a format, I'll listen to be up and current on changes and not behind, oh, go over the hill.
Well, we're going to go out with a record that you have great fondness for, greatest love of all, Whitney Houston. And my great thanks to Clive Davis for coming by to talk about his new book, The Soundtrack of My Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my needs.